The oath that I have solemnly taken tonight means at its core that I will do my job without any fear or favor, and that I will do so independently of both the political branches and of my own preferences.
Last night, Amy Coney Barrett became the 9th United States Supreme Court Justice. In one of the most partisan displays of power we've witnessed in the past few decades, Republicans used their political majority to force Barrett's confirmation before Election Day. So far, 60 million votes have already been cast in the 2020 election, and Barrett's nomination process was one of the fastest ever for a Supreme Court nominee, lasting a little more than a month after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Barrett answered less than 20% of the questions posed to her during her hearing, leaving many Americans unclear about how the new justice might lean, and frustrating Democrats who remember how President Obama's SCOTUS nominee Merrick Garland wasn't even granted a hearing. For the current GOP, it was the culmination of nearly four decades of work on reshaping the court. Mitch McConnell starkly said this on Sunday.
A lot of what we've done over the last 4 years will be undone sooner or later by the next election. We won't be able to do much about this for a long time to come.
While Republicans bask in the glory of their third Supreme Court justice in less than 4 years, millions of Americans continue to face eviction, hunger, unemployment, and a third wave of coronavirus infections, and Congress remains deadlocked on a stimulus package. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and that's where we start today with the new Supreme Court and how it has changed for the foreseeable future. Joining me now is Christian Farias, a legal affairs journalist and regular contributor to GQ magazine, and Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. Thanks for being with me, both of you.
Great.
Hello,
to be on.
Thanks for having me.
Amy, let's start with you. The process of how now Justice Barrett made her way to the Supreme Court has been remarkable in how quick it has gone. How did this happen so quickly?
It was remarkably fast, but I think Republicans were determined to have her on the court as quickly as possible. You know, this Mitch McConnell, and you really saw once Judge Barrett, now Justice Barrett, submitted her questionnaire. They had been really considering her for a vacancy for a couple of years, and you saw when she submitted her questionnaire to the Senate Judiciary Committee that within a day or two after Justice Ginsburg's death on September 18th, they had contacted her about the possibility of filling the vacancy and had offered her the job on September 21st, I believe. They didn't announce it until September 26th, and then, you know, just moved forward at lightning speed.
There is an editorial, the editorial board of the New York Times wrote today about this process. And I have to say, Amy, it's one thing to have a remarkably fast confirmation process. And it's another thing, in the words that they use in this editorial, to use, quote, brute force here. I think that's what's frustrating to watch, is how a lot of this feels less about the American public and its citizenry and more about brute force and power on the part of the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, there was not a lot that the Democrats could do once the nomination had been made to stop her. And the Democrats, you know, sort of recognized that. And the strategy at the confirmation hearing was really less about any sort of procedural maneuverings to try to stop her. And they really focused on, you know, sort of their differences and what her confirmation would mean for the court, rather than trying to change the minds of any senators as such.
Christian, I want to bring you in here, because to Amy's point, there wasn't a lot that Democrats could do, but did they do enough? I feel like there was a lot of grandstanding. There were a lot of photographs left there. They protested by not showing up, but I don't know. I mean, could they have asked more questions? Judge Barrett, now Justice Barrett, only answered about less than 20% of the questions she was posed. So what could the Democrats have done differently here?
They actually did everything they could do, given the circumstances. As Amy pointed out, they're in the minority. Their options were limited. And really, they hammered home the point that they've been trying to hammer even since the last election, that the Affordable Care Act is on the line. And indeed, the law is on the Supreme Court's docket at the moment. And their point, I don't know if they were successful, they try to paint her as a surefire vote against the law, given her past statements. And the question is, will she go with that, yes or no? Was that a pre-election strategy to drive out people to the polls more so than defeating her? I think that's a question that the election is going to answer, because depending on how well this strategy worked and how big a turnout Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation result in, I think they'll then decide, do we have a mandate to do something else? I think it's less about stopping her confirmation, but more about whether voters have it in them to truly, exact and I almost fear this word, revenge for what happened, you know, because millions, as the opening said, were already voting, 60 million as of yesterday. And in a sense, there's something quite anti-democratic about pushing through a nomination as votes are being cast and as people may be already voting because Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, because they want a justice that is kind of in her mold. And the fact that Amy Coney Barrett is the exact opposite of that, that may itself result in political retribution.
And I want to pick up on that point, Amy, because the idea that this is anti-democratic that Christian just pointed out, I think, again, pointing back to this New York Times editorial, where essentially, you know, it feels in many ways that the American, that the United States is somehow being held hostage by a very, by a minority view, quite frankly. And pointing out here that Republican presidents have appointed 14 of the previous 18 justices on the court. Americans have voted for Democratic nominees in 6 of the last 7 presidential elections. And yet this is what our Supreme Court looks like, Amy. How do we explain that?
I mean, I think that is what angers so many people. And, you know, I think for the Republicans that it really is, as Christian said, you're talking about, you know, there's the ongoing election, and it seems like Republican senators, at least, may well have made a calculation that they are going to take the, you know, and I'm to be sure, I'm not a congressional reporter, but take the short-term pain that they may well lose their majority in the Senate for the long-term gain of controlling the Supreme Court for, you know, possibly decades to come. You know, you had Senator McConnell the other day talking about, you know, how even if Democrats take the White House and, you know, both houses of Congress, they'll have this Supreme Court that's able to sort of push back against the, you know, the acts of Congress. I think that is what's frustrating Democrats so much and is, you know, part of the what's underlying the push, the calls for possibly expanding the court. You know, the Vice President Biden has said that he wants to appoint a commission to sort of study the courts. But, you know,
just when I hear that we're thinking about appointing a commission, it just feels like that's another piece of Washington rigmarole and just, you know, getting caught in the muck of Washington, when Americans are saying you may want to appoint a commission, but this administration has just appointed 3 judges in less than 4 years.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, you have to look back that, you know, I think people, that the idea that people are talking about court expansion sort of in the mainstream now, I think has come a long way. Like 2 years ago, even sort of whispering the word court packing was like completely taboo.
I want to get into court packing in a minute, because I want to talk about that strategically. But before we get to that, stand by, Amy. Christian, one of the things we hear over and over and over again is how judges should not legislate from the bench. And yet SCOTUS has, in many ways, because Congress is so broken, has had to become in many ways a legislative body. And pointing back to this New York Times editorial today, it says that today's conservative majority, and I'm quoting here, is among the most activist in the court's history. How do we explain the hypocrisy there, Christian?
It's interesting because the Republican agenda legislatively is so unpopular. The American public just doesn't want what Mitch McConnell and his party have to offer in terms of solutions for the American people, that the party turns to the courts to kind of enshrine their vision of society, their vision of how the world should work. So it's kind of this interesting interplay. You know, we don't have any bills to offer. We've already adjourned the Senate. McConnell last night adjourned the Senate until after the election without a COVID relief bill. You know, again, because his view of how that relief bill should look is not what people want. So rather than actually come to the table and offer solutions, he rather takes all his toys and go home. And the fact that he's now insisting instead on this new justice that will deliver outcomes for decades to come, a conservative majority, not just at the Supreme Court, but also in the federal appeals courts, which also decide many very important cases related to legislation and social policy. You know, it just shows kind of how they're planning to cement their vision for how Americans should live their lives. So,
but in the meantime, the problem is, as you mentioned, there are, you know, 8 million Americans have been pushed into poverty. And while the GOP has gotten its victory, it has kept its promise. President Trump in particular has kept his promise to make sure that they seat as many judges as they possibly can. They have done that, but they have abdicated their moral responsibility to the American public that is suffering right now. How do they expect to stand? And maybe this is to Amy's earlier point, that they're betting on the short term versus the long term.
Precisely. You know, and that's why it's interesting, because right now, based on this evident power grab, the question is, will voters respond? Will voters punish them? And we need to see what happens after the election, how big, if Biden wins, how big he wins. And also if he takes back the Senate, how big that take back is, because based on that mandate, they will now have to make a decision. What do we do to reverse this trend? Yes, of course, they have this whole agenda. Biden, I'm sure, has all these things he wants to do. But the question is, will the courts too push back on those policy agendas? And if the courts begin striking down Democratic legislation, which is what many progressives and many Democrats fear, that Amy Coney Barrett and the conservative majority now, let's say there's a new Voting Rights Act that will protect the right to vote moving forward. Will an activist Supreme Court go and do away with that? Then, you know, then what's even the point of passing Democratic legislation if you're going to have courts just striking it all down?
What is the concern about this word court packing?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure that there's that much of a concern right now. I think that Democrats are so upset about the way that things have played out, you know, the idea that the Gorsuch seat was a stolen seat, you know, that Mitch McConnell said we're not going to confirm a justice during the presidential election year, and then now that the Republicans are in the White House and they have the opportunity to confirm a justice during the presidential election year, and they went ahead and did it, you know, but it was taboo for a long time. I think that there was a sense that you know, talking about court packing might somehow hurt the Democrats in the upcoming elections. And, you know, I'm not sure that there's a sense that there is much of a harm right now from talking about it. The idea
What about term limits, Amy? What about that? What about in implementing or limiting the power of the court? Is that something that Democrats could do?
It's interesting because term limits to many people, I was actually talking about this with my 17-year-old daughter this morning, like it sounds like a much more reasonable idea to many people. You know, the idea that, you know, 18 years or so sounds very, very civilized, you know, and then you would know when a justice was going to roll off in advance of an upcoming presidential election. You'd say, okay, this president would get to pick the next nominee. But that actually, my understanding is that it would be hard, and Christian can correct me if I'm wrong, would be harder to do because the Constitution gives Supreme Court justices life tenure, whereas the Constitution does not set the number of justices on the Supreme Court. So, you know, it seems somewhat counterintuitive that adding justices to the court might actually be easier as a constitutional and legal matter than limiting their terms.
Christian, in terms of the way that what we know about Judge Barrett, and I'm not going to get into how she will rule on A or B topic, because we don't know how she's going to rule and we can't predict that. The question I have is how little we took away from her after these confirmation hearings. She answered less than 20% of the questions that were posed to her. And I would love if you could help us understand that in the context of, for example, Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation hearing. How different were the two?
Yeah, she was not forthcoming at all. I mean, there were basic questions that she got asked, like, is voter intimidation illegal? And she wouldn't answer that, when the reality is it is illegal. What does she have to say about the peaceful transfer of power, or, you know, other authoritarian tendencies of the current president? And she wouldn't answer those things. And of course, the reality is that she was just protecting her own nomination, because we know that the president tends to, you know, not take kindly to people who cross him. And so she was shrewd in that sense. But the reality is that, you know, she took part in this process. She accepted it for all it is, for all its rush. She appeared on the balcony of the White House South Lawn last night for what looked like a campaign event, because Donald Trump tweeted a video of it.
And that's also not typical or behavior for a Supreme Court justice, is it?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that were atypical about this process. And the fact that, you know, she kind of took it all in and she played along. I mean, she was in the middle of that super spreader event when she was announced for COVID. I mean, it just tells you something, that she was pretty much in the tank with this whole thing. And I think people should draw their own conclusions from that. The reality is that she is on the court right now. There are cases before the court dealing with this very election, whether mail-in ballots will be counted, whether, everyone
would she
who
be
has voted,
would she be forced to recuse herself from those cases?
She won't be forced to do anything. Supreme Court justices call their own shots when it comes to recusal. And the question is, will Amy Coney Barrett do the right thing? And the reality is that there's already a majority in the court that is hostile to voting rights. The question here is, will she join them or will she step aside? Just last night, there was a huge number of opinions from the Supreme Court dealing with voting in Wisconsin. There's another case from Pennsylvania pending, another one from North Carolina. And this is where the rubber will meet the road. And what she does in those cases will be just a demonstration of whether she is independent or not. And I think if she recuses, at least she will be showing the public that, that the stakes are high and that her own integrity is on the line.
Amy, as we close out the segment, what does this do? The whole process, the way that this, the you mentioned Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, and now we've got Amy Coney Barrett. I mean, very contentious nomination processes. And yet, like, as I mentioned, President Trump kept his promise to the American public by seating as many judges as he could. How has this changed the court for the foreseeable future? We've got about a minute and a half to go.
Yeah, so interestingly, until before the death of Justice Ginsburg, the Supreme Court sort of was doing actually fairly well in these polls involving public confidence. And so, you know, my impression has been that when you have something like this, the sort of perceptions of the Supreme Court do tend to take a hit. And then the Supreme Court, you know, usually will recover, but then it will take a hit again. But it will be, you know, the combination of this and the possibility that the Supreme Court could be drawn into election-related litigation, you know, I think it could certainly affect the public's perception. And you know, we saw this after Bush versus Gore. It may well take a while for the Supreme Court to recover.
Christian Farias is a legal affairs journalist and contributor to GQ magazine, and Amy Howe is the co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.